and fight her army on the eastern side, if that was his desire. Cyrus agreed, but instead of engaging the enemy directly, he decided to play a trick. The Massageti knew few luxuries. Once Cyrus had crossed the river and made his camp on the eastern side, he set the table for an elaborate banquet, full of meat, delicacies, and strong wine. Then he left his weakest troops in the camp and withdrew the rest of the army to the river. A large Massageti detachment soon attacked the camp and killed all of the Persian soldiers in a fierce battle. Then, overwhelmed by the fabulous feast that had been left behind, they ate and drank to their heart's content. Later, inevitably, they fell asleep. The Persian army returned to the camp that night, killing many of the sleeping soldiers and capturing the rest. Among the prisoners was their general, a youth named Spargopizes, son of Queen Tomyris. When the queen learned what had happened, she sent a message to Cyrus, chiding him for using tricks to defeat her army. "Now listen to me," she wrote, "and I will advise you for your own good. Give me back my son and leave my country with your forces intact, and be content with your triumph over a third part of the Massageti. If you refuse, I swear by the sun our master to give you more blood than you can drink for all your gluttony." Cyrus scoffed at her. He would not release her son. He would crush these barbarians. The queen's son, seeing he would not be released, could not stand the humiliation, and so he killed himself. The news of her son's death overwhelmed Tomyris. She gathered all the forces that she could muster in her kingdom, and whipping them into a vengeful frenzy, engaged Cyrus's troops in a violent and bloody battle. Finally, the Massageti prevailed. In their anger, they decimated the Persian army, killing Cyrus himself. After the battle, Tomyris and her soldiers searched the battlefield for Cyrus's corpse. When she found it, she cut off his head and shoved it into a wineskin full of human blood, crying out, "Though I have conquered you and live, yet you have ruined me by treacherously taking my son. See now, I fulfill my threat. You have your fill of blood." After Cyrus's death, the Persian Empire quickly unraveled. One act of arrogance undid all of Cyrus's good work. Interpretation. There is nothing more intoxicating than victory, and nothing more dangerous. Cyrus had built his great empire on the ruins of a previous one. 100 years earlier, the powerful Assyrian Empire had been totally destroyed, its once splendid capital of Nineveh, but ruins in the sand. The Assyrians had suffered this fate because they had pushed too far, destroying one city-state after another until they lost sight of the purpose of their victories and also of its costs. They overextended themselves and made many enemies who were finally able to band together and destroy them. Cyrus ignored the lesson of Assyria. He paid no heed to the warnings of oracles and advisers. He did not worry about offending a queen. His many victories had gone to his head, clouding his reason. Instead of consolidating his already vast empire, he pushed forward. Instead of recognizing each situation as different, he thought each new war would bring the same result as the one before, as long as he used the methods he knew, ruthless force and cunning. Understand, in the realm of power you must be guided by reason. To let a momentary thrill or an emotional victory influence or guide your moves will prove fatal. When you attain success, step back. Be cautious. When you gain victory, understand the part played by the particular circumstances of a situation, and never simply repeat the same actions again and again. History is littered with the ruins of victorious empires and the corpses of leaders who could not learn to stop and consolidate their gains. Observance of the law. No single person in history has occupied a more delicate and precarious position than the king's mistress. She had no real or legitimate power base to fall back on in times of trouble. She was surrounded by packs of envious courtiers, eagerly anticipating her fall from grace. And finally, since the source of her power was usually her physical beauty, for most royal mistresses that fall was inevitable and unpleasant. King Louis XV of France began to keep official mistresses in the early days of his reign, each woman's good fortune rarely lasting more than a few years. But then came Madame de Pompadour, who, when she was a middle-class child of 9 named Jean Poisson, had been told by a fortune teller that she would someday be the king's favorite. This seemed an absurd dream, since the royal mistress almost always came from the aristocracy. Jean nevertheless believed herself destined to seduce the king, and doing so became her obsession. She applied herself to the talents the king's favorite had to have, music, dancing, acting, horseback riding, and she excelled in every one of them. As a young woman, she married a man of lower nobility, which gave her an entree to the best salons in Paris. Word quickly spread of her beauty, talent, charm, and intelligence. Jean Poisson became close friends with Voltaire, Montesquieu, and other great minds of the time. But she never lost sight of the goal she had set herself as a girl, to capture the heart of the king. Her husband had a chateau in a forest where the king would often go hunting, and she began to spend a lot of time there. Studying his movements like a hawk, she would make sure he would happen to come upon her while she was out walking in her most alluring dress, or riding in her splendid coach. The king began to take note of her, making her gifts of the game he caught in the hunt. In 1744, Louis's current mistress, the Duchesse de Chanteloup, died. Jean went on the offensive. She placed herself everywhere he would be, at masked balls at Versailles, at the opera, wherever their paths would cross, and wherever she could display her many talents, dancing, singing, writing, coquetry. The king finally succumbed to her charms, and in a ceremony at Versailles, in September of 1745, this 24-year-old daughter of a middle-class banking agent was officially inaugurated as the king's mistress. She was given her own room in the palace, a room the king could enter at any time, via a hidden stairway and back door. And because some of the courtiers were angry that he had chosen a woman of low origins, he made her a marquise. From now on, she would be known as Madame de Pompadour. The king was a man whom the slightest feeling of boredom would oppress out of proportion. Madame de Pompadour knew that keeping him under her spell meant keeping him amused. To that end, she put on constant theatrical productions at Versailles, in which she starred. She organized elaborate hunting parties, masked balls, and whatever else it would take to keep him diverted outside the bedroom. She became a patroness of the arts and the arbiter of taste and fashion for all of France. Her enemies at the court only grew in number with each new success, but Madame de Pompadour thwarted them in a totally novel way for a king's mistress, with extreme politeness. Snobs who resented her for her low birth she won over with charm and grace. Most unusual of all, she befriended the queen, and insisted that Louis XV pay more attention to his wife and treat her more kindly. Even the royal family begrudgingly gave her their support. To crown her glory, the king made her a duchess. Her sway was felt even in politics. Indeed, she became the untitled Minister of Foreign Affairs. In 1751, when Madame de Pompadour was at the height of her power, she experienced her worst crisis. Physically weakened by the responsibilities of her position, she found it increasingly difficult to meet the king's demands in bed. This was usually the point at which the mistress would meet her end, struggling to maintain her position as her beauty faded. But Madame de Pompadour had a strategy. She encouraged the king to set up a kind of brothel, Parc Auxerre, on the grounds of Versailles. There the middle-aged king could have liaisons with the most beautiful young girls in the realm. Madame de Pompadour knew that her charm and her political acumen had made her indispensable to the king. What did she have to fear from a 16-year-old who had none of her power and presence? What did it matter if she lost her position in the bedroom, as long as she remained the most powerful woman in France? To secure that position, she became still closer friends with the queen, with whom she started attending church. Although her enemies at the court conspired to have her toppled from her official position as the king's mistress, the king kept her on, for he needed her calming effect. It was only when her part in the disastrous 7 Years' War drew much criticism on her that she slowly withdrew from public affairs. Madame de Pompadour's health had always been delicate, and she died at the age of 43 in 1764. Her reign as mistress had lasted an unprecedented 20 years. "She was regretted by all," wrote the Duc de Cui, "for she was kindly and helpful to everyone who approached her." Interpretation. Aware of the temporariness of her power, the king's mistress would often go into a kind of frenzy after capturing the king. She would try to accumulate as much money as possible to protect her after her inevitable fall. And to extend her reign as long as possible, she would be ruthless with her enemies in the court. Her situation, in other words, seemed to demand from her a greed and vindictiveness that would often be her undoing. Madame de Pompadour succeeded where all others had failed because she never pressed her good fortune. Instead of bullying the courtiers from her powerful position as the king's mistress, she tried to win their support. She never revealed the slightest hint of greed or arrogance. When she could no longer perform her physical duties as mistress, she didn't fret at the thought of someone replacing her in bed. She simply applied some strategy. She encouraged the king to take young lovers, knowing that the younger and prettier they were, the less of a threat they posed, since they could not compare to her in charm and sophistication, and would soon bore the monarch. Success plays strange tricks on the mind. It makes you feel invulnerable, while also making you more hostile and emotional when people challenge your power. It makes you less able to adapt to circumstance. You come to believe that your character is more responsible for your success than your strategizing and planning. Like Madame de Pompadour, you need to realize that your moment of triumph is also a moment when you have to rely on cunning and strategy all the more, consolidating your power base, recognizing the role of luck and circumstance in your success, and remaining vigilant against changes in your good fortune. It is the moment of victory when you need to play the courtier's game and pay more attention than ever to the laws of power. As Napoleon Bonaparte said, the greatest danger occurs at the moment of victory. Keys to power. Power has its own rhythms and patterns. Those who succeed at the game are the ones who control the patterns and vary them at will, keeping people off balance while they set the tempo. The essence of strategy is controlling what comes next, and the elation of victory can upset your ability to control what comes next in two ways. First, you owe your success to a pattern that you are apt to try to repeat. You will try to keep moving in the same direction without stopping to see whether this is still the direction that is best for you. Second, success tends to go to your head and make you emotional. Feeling invulnerable, you make aggressive moves that ultimately undo the victory you've gained. The lesson is simple. The powerful vary their rhythms and patterns, change course, adapt to circumstance, and learn to improvise. Rather than letting their dancing feet impel them forward, they step back and look where they're going. It is as if their bloodstream bore a kind of antidote to the intoxication of victory, letting them control their emotions and come to a kind of mental halt when they have attained success. They steady themselves, give themselves the space to reflect on what has happened. Examine the role of circumstance and luck in their success. As they say in riding school, you have to be able to control yourself before you can control the horse. Luck and circumstance always play a role in power. This is inevitable, and actually makes the game more interesting. But despite what you may think, good luck is more dangerous than bad luck. Bad luck teaches valuable lessons about patience, timing, and the need to be prepared for the worst. Good luck deludes you into the opposite lesson, making you think your brilliance will carry you through. Your fortune will inevitably turn, and when it does, you will be completely unprepared. According to Machiavelli, this is what undid Cesare Borgia. He had many triumphs, was actually a clever strategist, but had the bad luck to have good luck. He had a pope for a father. Then, when he had bad luck for real, his father's death, he was unprepared for it, and the many enemies he had made devoured him. The good luck that elevates you or seals your success brings the moment for you to open your eyes. The wheel of fortune will hurtle you down as easily as up. If you prepare for the fall, it is less likely to ruin you when it happens. People who have a run of success can catch a kind of fever. And even when they themselves try to stay calm, the people below them often pressure them to go past their mark and into dangerous waters. You have to have a strategy for dealing with these people. Simply preaching moderation will make you look weak and small-minded. Seeming to fail to follow up on a victory can lessen your power. When the Athenian general and statesman Pericles led a series of naval campaigns around the Black Sea in 436 BC, His easy triumphs inflamed the Athenians' desire for more. They dreamed of conquering Egypt, overrunning Persia, sailing for Sicily. On the one hand, Pericles reined in these dangerous emotions by warning of the perils of hubris. On the other hand, he fed them by fighting small battles that he knew he could win, creating the appearance that he was preserving the momentum of success. The skill with which Pericles played this game is revealed by what happened when he died. The demagogues took over, pushed Athens into invading Sicily, and in one rash move, destroyed an empire. The rhythm of power often requires an alternation of force and cunning. Too much force creates a counter-reaction. Too much cunning, no matter how cunning it is, becomes predictable. Working on behalf of his master, the shogun Oda Nobunaga, the great 16th-century Japanese general and future emperor Hideyoshi once engineered a stunning victory over the army of the formidable general Yoshimoto. The shogun wanted to go further, to take on and crush yet another powerful enemy. But Hideyoshi reminded him of the old Japanese saying, "When you have won a victory, tighten the strings of your helmet." For Hideyoshi, this was the moment for the shogun to switch from force to cunning and indirection, setting his enemies against one another through a series of deceptive alliances. In this way, he would avoid stirring up needless opposition by appearing overly aggressive. When you are victorious, then lie low and lull the enemy into inaction. These changes of rhythm are immensely powerful. People who go past the mark are often motivated by a desire to please a master by proving their dedication. But an excess of effort exposes you to the risk of making the master suspicious of you. On several occasions, generals under Philip of Macedon were disgraced and demoted immediately after leading their troops to a great victory. One more such victory, Philip thought, and the man might become a rival instead of an underling. When you serve a master, it is often wise to measure your victories carefully, letting him get the glory and never making him uneasy. It is also wise to establish a pattern of strict obedience to earn his trust. In the 4th century BC, a captain under the notoriously severe Chinese general Wu Qi charged ahead before a battle had begun and came back with several enemy heads. He thought he had shown his fiery enthusiasm, but Wu Qi was unimpressed. "A talented officer," the general said with a sigh as he ordered the man beheaded, "but a disobedient one." Another moment when a small success can spoil the chances for a larger one may come if a master or superior grants you a favor. It is a dangerous mistake to ask for more. You will seem insecure. Perhaps you feel you did not deserve this favor and have to grab as much as you can when you have the chance, which may not come again. The proper response is to accept the favor graciously and withdraw. Any subsequent favors you should earn without having to ask for them. Finally, the moment when you stop has great dramatic import. What comes last sticks in the mind as a kind of exclamation point. There is no better time to stop and walk away than after a victory. Keep going, and you risk lessening the effect, even ending up defeated. As lawyers say of cross-examination, always stop with a victory. Reversal. As Machiavelli says, either destroy a man or leave him alone entirely. Inflicting half punishment or mild injury will only create an enemy whose bitterness will grow with time and who will take revenge. When you beat an enemy, then, make your victory complete. Crush him into non-existence. In the moment of victory, you do not restrain yourself from crushing the enemy you have defeated, but rather from needlessly advancing against others. Be merciless with your enemy, but do not create new enemies by overreaching. There are some who become more cautious than ever after a victory, which they see as just giving them more possessions to worry about and protect. Your caution after victory should never make you hesitate or lose momentum, but rather act as a safeguard against rash action. On the other hand, momentum as a phenomenon is greatly overrated. You create your own successes, and if they follow one upon the other, it is your own doing. Belief in momentum will only make you emotional, less prone to act strategically, and more apt to repeat the same methods. leave momentum for those who have nothing better to rely upon. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Leo Tolstoy, Fable of the Vainglorious Cockerel. Two cockerels fought on a dung heap. One cockerel was the stronger. He vanquished the other and drove him from the dung heap. All the hens gathered around the cockerel and began to laud him. The cockerel wanted his strength and glory to be known in the next yard. He flew on top of the barn, flapped his wings, and crowed in a loud voice, "Look at me, all of you. I am a victorious cockerel. No other cockerel in the world has such strength as I." The cockerel hadn't finished when an eagle killed him, seized him in his claws, and carried him to his nest. From Francis L. Wellman, The Sequence of Cross-Examination. In all your cross-examinations, most important of all, let me repeat the injunction to be ever on the alert for a good place to stop. Nothing can be more important than to close your examination with a triumph. So many lawyers succeed in catching a witness in a serious contradiction, but, not satisfied with this, go on asking questions and taper off their examination until the effect upon the jury of their former advantage is lost altogether. From Niccolo Machiavelli, The Overreaching General. We read of many instances of this kind. For the general who, by his valor, has conquered a state for his master, and won great glory for himself by his victory over the enemy, and has loaded his soldiers with rich booty, acquires necessarily with his own soldiers, as well as with those of the enemy, and with the subjects of the prince, so high a reputation, that his very victory may become distasteful, and a cause for apprehension to his prince. For as the nature of men is ambitious as well as suspicious, and puts no limits to one's good fortune, it is not impossible that the suspicion that may suddenly be aroused in the mind of the prince by the victory of the general may have been aggravated by some haughty expressions or insolent acts on his part, so that the prince will naturally be made to think of securing himself against the ambition of his general. And to do this, the means that suggest themselves to him are either to have the general killed, or to deprive him of that reputation which he has acquired with the prince's army, and the people, by using every means to prove that the general's victory was not due to his skill and courage, but to chance and the cowardice of the enemy, or to the sagacity of the other captains who were with him in that action. And from Kinkel, Essays in Idleness. A man who was famous as a tree climber was guiding someone in climbing a tall tree. He ordered the man to cut the top branches, and during this time, when the man seemed to be in great danger, the expert said nothing. Only when the man was coming down and had reached the height of the eaves did the expert call out, "Be careful. Watch your step coming down." I asked him, "Why did you say that? At that height he could jump the rest of the way if he chose." "That's the point," said the expert. "As long as the man was up at a dizzying height and the branches were threatening to break, he himself was so afraid, I said nothing. Mistakes are always made when people get to the easy places." This man belonged to the lowest class, but his words were in perfect accord with the precepts of the sages. In football, too, they say that after you have kicked out of a difficult place and you think the next one will be easier, you are sure to miss the ball. The 48th Law. Assume formlessness. Judgment. By taking a shape, by having a visible plan, you open yourself to attack. Instead of taking a form for your enemy to grasp, keep yourself adaptable and on the move. Accept the fact that nothing is certain and no law is fixed. The best way to protect yourself is to be as fluid and formless as water. Never bet on stability or lasting order. Everything changes. Transgression of the law. By the 8th century B.C., the city-states of Greece had grown so large and prosperous that they had run out of land to support their expanding populations. So they turned to the sea, establishing colonies in Asia Minor, Sicily, the Italian peninsula, even Africa. The city-state of Sparta, however, was landlocked and surrounded by mountains. Lacking access to the Mediterranean, the Spartans never became a seafaring people. Instead, they turned on the cities around them, and, in a series of brutal, violent conflicts lasting more than 100 years, managed to conquer an immense area that would provide enough land for their citizens. This solution to their problem, however, brought a new, more formidable one. How could they maintain and police their conquered territories? The subordinate peoples they ruled now outnumbered them 10 to 1. Surely this horde would take a horrible revenge on them. Sparta's solution was to create a society dedicated to the art of war. Spartans would be tougher, stronger, and fiercer than their neighbors. This was the only way they could ensure their stability and survival. When a Spartan boy reached the age of 7, he was taken from his mother and placed in a military club, where he was trained to fight and underwent the strictest discipline. The boys slept on beds of reeds. They were allotted only one outer garment to wear for an entire year. They studied none of the arts. Indeed, the Spartans banned music and permitted only slaves to practice the crafts that were necessary to sustain them. The only skills the Spartans taught were those of warfare. Children seen as weaklings were left to die in a cavern in the mountains. No system of money or trading was allowed in Sparta. Acquired wealth, they believed, would sow selfishness and dissension, weakening their warrior discipline. The only way a Spartan could earn a living was through agriculture, mostly on state-owned lands, which slaves, called helots, would work for him. The Spartans' single-mindedness allowed them to forge the most powerful infantry in the world. They marched in perfect order and fought with incomparable bravery. Their tight-knit phalanxes could vanquish an army 10 times their size, as they proved in defeating the Persians at Thermopylae. A Spartan column on the march would strike terror in the enemy. It seemed to have no weaknesses. Yet although the Spartans proved themselves mighty warriors, they had no interest in creating an empire. They only wanted to keep what they had already conquered and to defend it against invaders. Decades would pass without a single change in the system that had succeeded so well in preserving Sparta's status quo. At the same time that the Spartans were evolving their warlike culture, another city-state was rising to equal prominence, Athens. Unlike Sparta, Athens had taken to the sea, not so much to create colonies as for purposes of trade. The Athenians became great merchants. Their currency, the famous owl coins, spread throughout the Mediterranean. Unlike the rigid Spartans, the Athenians responded to every problem with consummate creativity, adapting to the occasion, and creating new social forms and new arts at an incredible pace. Their society was in constant flux, and as their power grew, they came to pose a threat to the defense-minded Spartans. In 431 BC, the war that had been brewing between Athens and Sparta for so long finally erupted. It lasted 27 years, but after many twists of fortune, the Spartan war machine finally emerged victorious. The Spartans now commanded an empire. This time they could not stay in their shell. If they gave up what they had gained, the beaten Athenians would regroup and rise against them, and the long war would have been fought for naught. After the war, Athenian money poured into Sparta. The Spartans had been trained in warfare, not politics or economics. Because they were so unaccustomed to it, wealth and its accompanying ways of life seduced and overwhelmed them. Spartan governors were sent to rule what had been Athenian lands. Far from home, they succumbed to the worst forms of corruption. Sparta had defeated Athens, but the fluid Athenian way of life was slowly breaking down its discipline and loosening its rigid order. And Athens, meanwhile, was adapting to losing its empire, managing to thrive as a cultural and economic center. Confused by a change in its status quo, Sparta grew weaker and weaker. Some 30 years after defeating Athens, it lost an important battle with the city-state of Thebes. Almost overnight, this once mighty nation collapsed, never to recover. Interpretation. In the evolution of species, protective armor has almost always spelled disaster. Although there are a few exceptions, the shell most often becomes a dead end for the animal encased in it. It slows the creature down, making it hard for it to forage for food, and making it a target for fast-moving predators. Animals that take to the sea or sky, and that move swiftly and unpredictably, are infinitely more powerful and secure. In facing a serious problem, controlling superior numbers, Sparta reacted like an animal that develops a shell to protect itself from the environment. But like a turtle, the Spartans sacrificed mobility for safety. They managed to preserve stability for 300 years, but at what cost? They had no culture beyond warfare, no arts to relieve the tension, a constant anxiety about the status quo. While their neighbors took to the sea, learning to adapt to a world of constant motion, the Spartans entombed themselves in their own system. Victory would mean new lands to govern, which they did not want. Defeat would mean the end of their military machine, which they did not want either. Only stasis allowed them to survive. But nothing in the world can remain stable forever, and the shell or system you evolve for your protection will someday prove your undoing. In the case of Sparta, it was not the armies of Athens that defeated it, but the Athenian money. Money flows everywhere it has the opportunity to go. It cannot be controlled or made to fit a prescribed pattern. It is inherently chaotic. And in the long run, money made Athens the conqueror, by infiltrating the Spartan system and corroding its protective armor. In the battle between the two systems, Athens was fluid and creative enough to take new forms, while Sparta could grow only more rigid until it cracked. This is the way the world works, whether for animals, cultures, or individuals. In the face of the world's harshness and danger, organisms of any kind develop protection, a coat of armor, a rigid system, a comforting ritual. For the short term, it may work, but for the long term, it spells disaster. People weighed down by a system and inflexible ways of doing things cannot move fast, cannot sense or adapt to change. They lumber around more and more slowly until they go the way of the brontosaurus. Learn to move fast and adapt, or you will be eaten. The best way to avoid this fate is to assume formlessness. No predator alive can attack what it cannot see. Observance of the law. When World War II ended and the Japanese, who had invaded China in 1937, had finally been thrown out, the Chinese nationalists, led by Chiang Kai-shek, decided the time had come to annihilate the Chinese communists, their hated rivals, once and for all. They had almost succeeded in 1935, forcing the communists into the Long March, the grueling retreat that had greatly diminished their numbers. Although the communists had recovered somewhat during the war against Japan, it wouldn't be difficult to defeat them now. They controlled only isolated areas in the countryside, had unsophisticated weaponry, lacked any military experience or training beyond mountain fighting, and controlled no important parts of China except areas of Manchuria, which they had managed to take after the Japanese retreat. Chiang decided to commit his best forces in Manchuria. He would take over its major cities, and from those bases would spread through this northern industrial region, sweeping the communists away. Once Manchuria had fallen, the communists would collapse. In 1945 and 46, the plan worked perfectly. The nationalists easily took the major Manchurian cities. Puzzlingly, though, in the face of this critical campaign, the communist strategy made no sense. When the nationalists began their push, the communists dispersed to Manchuria's most out-of-the-way corners. Their small units harassed the nationalist armies, ambushing them here, retreating unexpectedly there. But these dispersed units never linked up, making them hard to attack. They would seize a town, only to give it up a few weeks later. Forming neither rear guards nor vanguards, they moved like mercury, never staying in one place, elusive and formless. The nationalists ascribed this to two things: cowardice in the face of superior forces, and inexperience in strategy. Mao Zedong, the communist leader, was more a poet and philosopher than a general, whereas Chiang had studied warfare in the West and was a follower of the German military writer Karl von Clausewitz, among others. Yet a pattern did eventually emerge in Mao's attacks. After the nationalists had taken the cities, leaving the communists to occupy what was generally considered Manchuria's useless space, the communists started using that large space to surround the cities. If Chang sent an army from one city to reinforce another, the communists would encircle the rescuing army. Chang's forces were slowly broken into smaller and smaller units, isolated from one another, their lines of supply and communication cut. The Nationalists still had superior firepower, but if they could not move, what good was it? A kind of terror overcame the Nationalist soldiers. Commanders comfortably remote from the front lines might laugh at Mao, but the soldiers had fought the communists in the mountains and had come to fear their elusiveness. Now these soldiers sat in their cities and watched as their fast-moving enemies, as fluid as water, poured in on them from all sides. There seemed to be millions of them. The communists also encircled the soldiers' spirit, bombarding them with propaganda to lower their morale and pressure them to desert. The Nationalists began to surrender in their minds. Their encircled and isolated cities started collapsing even before being directly attacked. One after another fell in quick succession. In November of 1948, the Nationalists surrendered Manchuria to the Communists, a humiliating blow to the technically superior Nationalist army, and one that proved decisive in the war. By the following year, the Communists controlled all of China. Interpretation. The two board games that best approximate the strategies of war are chess and the Asian game of Go. In chess, the board is small. In comparison to Go, the attack comes relatively quickly, forcing a decisive battle. It rarely pays to withdraw or to sacrifice your pieces, which must be concentrated at key areas. Go is much less formal. It is played on a large grid with 361 intersections, nearly six times as many positions as in chess. Black and white stones, one color for each side, are placed on the board's intersections, one at a time, wherever you like. Once all your stones, 52 for each side, are on the board, the object is to isolate the stones of your opponent by encircling them. The game of Go, called Wei Qi in China, can last up to 300 moves. The strategy is more subtle and fluid than chess, developing slowly. The more complex the pattern your stones initially create on the board, the harder it is for your opponent to understand your strategy. Fighting to control a particular area is not worth the trouble. You have to think in larger terms, to be prepared to sacrifice an area in order eventually to dominate the board. What you are after is not an entrenched position, but mobility. With mobility, you can isolate the opponent in small areas, and then encircle them. The aim is not to kill off your opponent's pieces directly, as in chess, but to induce a kind of paralysis and collapse. Chess is linear, position-oriented, and aggressive. Go is nonlinear and fluid. Aggression is indirect until the end of the game, when the winner can surround the opponent's stones at an accelerated pace. Chinese military strategists have been influenced by Go for centuries. Its proverbs have been applied to war time and again. Mao Zedong was an addict of Wei Qi, and its precepts were ingrained in his strategies. A key Wei Qi concept, for example, is to use the size of the board to your advantage, spreading out in every direction so that your opponent cannot fathom your movements in a simple, linear way. Every Chinese, Mao once wrote, should consciously throw himself into this war of a jigsaw pattern against the Nationalists. Place your men in a jigsaw pattern and go, and your opponent loses himself trying to figure out what you're up to. Either he wastes time pursuing you, or, like Chiang Kai-shek, he assumes you're incompetent and fails to protect himself. And if he concentrates on single areas, as Western strategy advises, he becomes a sitting duck for encirclement. In the Wei Qi way of war, you encircle the enemy's brain, using mind games, propaganda, and irritation tactics to confuse and dishearten. This was the strategy of the communists, an apparent formlessness that disoriented and terrified their enemy. Where chess is linear and direct, the ancient game of Go is closer to the kind of strategy that will prove relevant in a war where battles are fought indirectly, in vast, loosely connected areas. Its strategies are abstract and multidimensional, inhabiting a plane beyond time and space, the strategist's mind. In this fluid form of warfare, you value movement over position. Your speed and mobility make it impossible to predict your moves. Unable to understand you, your enemy can form no strategy to defeat you. Instead of fixing on particular spots, this indirect form of warfare spreads out. Just as you can use the large and disconnected nature of the real world to your advantage. Be like a vapor. Do not give your opponents anything solid to attack. Watch as they exhaust themselves pursuing you, trying to cope with your elusiveness. Only formlessness allows you to truly surprise your enemies. By the time they figure out where you are and what you're up to, it is too late. As Mao said, "When you want to fight us, we don't let you, and you can't find us. But when we want to fight you, we make sure that you can't get away, and we hit you squarely and wipe you out. The enemy advances, we retreat. The enemy camps, we harass. The enemy tires, we attack. The enemy retreats, we pursue." Keys to power. The human animal is distinguished by its constant creation of forms. Rarely expressing its emotions directly, it gives them form through language or through socially acceptable rituals. We cannot communicate our emotions without a form. The forms that we create, however, change constantly, in fashion, in style, in all those human phenomena representing the mood of the moment. We are constantly altering the forms we have inherited from previous generations, and these changes are signs of life and vitality. Indeed, the things that don't change, the forms that rigidify, come to look to us like death, and we destroy them. The young show this most clearly. Uncomfortable with the forms that society imposes upon them, having no set identity, they play with their own characters, trying on a variety of masks and poses to express themselves. This is the vitality that drives the motor of form, creating constant changes in style. The powerful are often people who, in their youth, have shown immense creativity in expressing something new through a new form. Society grants them power because it hungers for and rewards this sort of newness. The problem comes later, when they often grow conservative and possessive. They no longer dream of creating new forms. Their identities are set, their habits congeal, and their rigidity makes them easy targets. Everyone knows their next move. Instead of demanding respect, they elicit boredom. "Get off the stage," we say. "Let someone else, someone younger, entertain us." When locked in the past, the powerful look comical. They are overripe fruit, waiting to fall from the tree. Power can only thrive if it is flexible in its forms. To be formless is not to be amorphous. Everything has a form it's impossible to avoid. The formlessness of power is more like that of water, or mercury, taking the form of whatever is around it. Changing constantly, it is never predictable. The powerful are constantly creating form, and their power comes from the rapidity with which they can change. Their formlessness is in the eye of the enemy who cannot see what they're up to and so has nothing solid to attack. This is the premier pose of power. Ungraspable, as elusive and swift as the god Mercury, who could take any form he pleased and use this ability to wreak havoc on Mount Olympus. Human creations evolve toward abstraction, toward being more mental and less material. This evolution is clear in art, which, in this century, made the great discovery of abstraction and conceptualism. It can also be seen in politics, which over time have become less overtly violent, more complicated, indirect, and cerebral. Warfare and strategy, too, have followed this pattern. Strategy began in the manipulation of armies on land, positioning them in ordered formations. On land, strategy is relatively two-dimensional and controlled by topography. But all the great powers have eventually taken to the sea for commerce and colonization. And to protect their trading lanes, they have had to learn how to fight at sea. Maritime warfare requires tremendous creativity and abstract thinking, since the lines are constantly shifting. Naval captains distinguish themselves by their ability to adapt to the literal fluidity of the terrain. and to confuse the enemy with an abstract, hard-to-anticipate form. They are operating in a third dimension, the mind. Back on land, guerrilla warfare, too, demonstrates this evolution toward abstraction. T.E. Lawrence was perhaps the first modern strategist to develop the theory behind this kind of warfare, and to put it into practice. His ideas influenced Mao, who found in his writings an uncanny Western equivalent to Wei Qi. Lawrence was working with Arabs, fighting for their territory against the Turks. His idea was to make the Arabs blend into the vast desert, never providing a target, never collecting together in one place. As the Turks scrambled to fight this vaporous army, they spread themselves thin, wasting energy and moving from place to place. They had the superior firepower, but the Arabs kept the initiative by playing cat and mouse, giving the Turks nothing to hold on to, destroying their morale. Most wars were wars of contact. Ours should be a war of detachment, Lawrence wrote. We were to contain the enemy by the silent threat of a vast, unknown desert, not disclosing ourselves till we attacked. This is the ultimate form of strategy. The war of engagement has become far too dangerous and costly. Indirection and elusiveness yield far better results at a much lower cost. The main cost, in fact, is mental, the thinking it takes to align your forces in scattered patterns, and to undermine the minds and psychology of your opponents. And nothing will infuriate and disorient them more than formlessness. In a world where wars of detachment are the order of the day, formlessness is crucial. The first psychological requirement of formlessness is to train yourself to take nothing personally. Never show any defensiveness. When you act defensive, you show your emotions, revealing a clear form. Your opponents will realize that they have hit a nerve, an Achilles heel, and they will hit it again and again. So train yourself to take nothing personally. Never let anyone get your back up. Be like a slippery ball that cannot be held. Let no one know what gets to you or where your weaknesses lie. Make your face a formless mask and you will infuriate and disorient your scheming colleagues and opponents. One man who used this technique was Baron James Rothschild. A German Jew in Paris, in a culture decidedly unfriendly to foreigners, Rothschild never took any attack on him personally or showed he had been hurt in any way. He furthermore adapted himself to the political climate, whatever it was, the stiffy formal restoration monarchy of Louis XVIII, the bourgeois reign of Louis Philippe, the Democratic Revolution of 1848, the upstart Louis Napoleon crowned emperor in 1852. Rothschild accepted them one and all and blended in. He could afford to appear hypocritical or opportunistic because he was valued for his money, not his politics. His money was the currency of power. While he adapted and thrived, outwardly never showing a form, all the other great families that had begun the century immensely wealthy were ruined in the period's complicated shifts and turns of fortune. Attaching themselves to the past, they revealed their embrace of a form. Throughout history, the formless style of ruling has been most adeptly practiced by the queen, who reigns alone. A queen is in a radically different position from a king. Because she is a woman, her subjects and courtiers are likely to doubt her ability to rule, her strength of character. If she favors one side in some ideological struggle, she is said to be acting out of emotional attachment. Yet if she represses her emotions and plays the authoritarian in the male fashion, she arouses worse criticism still. Either by nature or by experience, then, queens tend to adopt a flexible style of governing that in the end often proves more powerful than the more direct male form. Two female leaders exemplifying the formless style of rule are Queen Elizabeth of England and Empress Catherine the Great of Russia. In the violent wars between Catholics and Protestants, Elizabeth steered a middle course. She avoided alliances that would commit her to one side, and that over time would harm the country. She managed to keep her country at peace until it was strong enough for war. Her reign was one of the most glorious in history because of her incredible capacity to adapt and her flexible ideology. Catherine the Great, too, evolved an improvisatory style of governing. After she deposed her husband, Emperor Peter II, taking sole control of Russia in 1762, no one thought she would survive. But she had no preconceived ideas, no philosophy or theory to dictate her policies. Although a foreigner, she came from Germany, she understood Russia's moods and how it was changing over the years. One must govern in such a way that one's people think they themselves want to do what one commands them to do, she said. And to do this, she had to be always a step ahead of their desires, and to adapt to their resistance. By never forcing the issue, she reformed Russia in a strikingly short period of time. This feminine, formless style of ruling may have emerged as a way of prospering under difficult circumstances, but it has proved immensely seductive to those who have served under it. Being fluid, it is relatively easy for its subjects to obey, for they feel less coerced, less bent to their ruler's ideology. It also opens up options where an adherence to a doctrine closes them off. Without committing to one side, it allows the ruler to play one enemy off another. Rigid rulers may seem strong, but with time their inflexibility wears on the nerves, and their subjects find ways to push them from the stage. Flexible, formless rulers will be much criticized, but they will endure, and people will eventually come to identify with them, since they are as their subjects are, changing with the wind, open to circumstance. Despite upsets and delays, the permeable style of power generally triumphs in the end, just as Athens eventually won victory over Sparta through its money and its culture. When you find yourself in conflict with someone stronger and more rigid, allow them a momentary victory. Seem to bow to their superiority. Then, by being formless and adaptable, slowly insinuate yourself into their soul. This way you will catch them off guard, for rigid people are always ready to ward off direct blows, but are helpless against the subtle and insinuating. To succeed at such a strategy, you must play the chameleon. Conform on the surface while breaking down your enemy from the inside. For centuries, the Japanese would accept foreigners graciously and appeared susceptible to foreign cultures and influences. João Rodrigues, a Portuguese priest who arrived in Japan in 1577 and lived there for many years, wrote, "I am flabbergasted by the Japanese willingness to try and accept everything Portuguese." He saw Japanese in the streets wearing Portuguese clothing, with rosary beads at their necks and crosses at their hips. This might seem like a weak, mutable culture, but Japan's adaptability actually protected the country from having an alien culture imposed by military invasion. It seduced the Portuguese and other Westerners into believing the Japanese were yielding to a superior culture, when actually the foreign culture's ways were merely a fashion to be donned and doffed. Under the surface, Japanese culture thrived. Had the Japanese been rigid about foreign influences and tried to fight them off, they might have suffered the injuries that the West inflicted on China. That is the power of formlessness. It gives the aggressor nothing to react against, nothing to hit. In evolution, largeness is often the first step toward extinction. What is immense and bloated has no mobility, but must constantly feed itself. The unintelligent are often seduced into believing that size connotes power. The bigger, the better. In 483 BC, King Xerxes of Persia invaded Greece, believing he could conquer the country in one easy campaign. After all, he had the largest army ever assembled for one invasion. The historian Herodotus estimated it at over 5 million. The Persians planned to build a bridge across the Hellespont to overrun Greece from the land, while their equally immense navy would pin the Greek ships in harbor, preventing their forces from escaping to sea. The plan seemed sure, yet as Xerxes prepared the invasion, his advisor, Artabanus, warned his master of grave misgivings. "The two mightiest powers in the world are against you," he said. Xerxes laughed. What powers could match his gigantic army? "I will tell you what they are," answered Artabanus. "The land and the sea." There were no safe harbors large enough to receive Xerxes' fleet. And the more land the Persians conquered, and the longer their supply line stretched, the more ruinous the cost of feeding this immense army would prove. Thinking his advisor a coward, Xerxes proceeded with the invasion. Yet as Artabanus predicted, bad weather at sea decimated the Persian fleet, which was too large to take shelter in any harbor. On land, meanwhile, the Persian army destroyed everything in its path, which only made it impossible to feed, since the destruction included crops and stores of food. It was also an easy and slow-moving target. The Greeks practiced all kinds of deceptive maneuvers to disorient the Persians. Xerxes' eventual defeat at the hands of the Greek allies was an immense disaster. The story is emblematic of all those who sacrifice mobility for size. The flexible and fleet of foot will almost always win, for they have more strategic options. The more gigantic the enemy, the easier it is to induce collapse. The need for formlessness becomes greater the older we get, as we grow more likely to become set in our ways and assume too rigid a form. We become predictable, always the first sign of decrepitude. And predictability makes us appear comical. Although ridicule and disdain might seem mild forms of attack, they are actually potent weapons, and will eventually erode a foundation of power. An enemy who doesn't respect you will grow bold, and boldness makes even the smallest animal dangerous. The late 18th century court of France, as exemplified by Marie Antoinette, had become so hopelessly tied to a rigid formality that the average Frenchman thought it a silly relic. This depreciation of a centuries-old institution was the first sign of a terminal disease, for it represented a symbolic loosening of the people's ties to monarchy. As the situation worsened, Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI grew only more rigid in their adherence to the past, and quickened their path to the guillotine. King Charles I of England reacted similarly to the tide of democratic change brewing in England in the 1630s. He disbanded Parliament, and his court rituals grew increasingly formal and distant. He wanted to return to an older style of ruling, with adherence to all kinds of petty protocol. His rigidity only heightened the desire for change. Soon, of course, he was swept up in a devastating civil war, and eventually lost his head to the executioner's axe. As you get older, you must rely even less on the past. Be vigilant, lest the form your character has taken makes you seem a relic. It's not a matter of mimicking the fashions of youth. That is equally worthy of laughter. Rather, your mind must constantly adapt to each circumstance, even the inevitable change that the time has come to move over and let those of younger age prepare for their ascendancy. Rigidity will only make you look uncannily like a cadaver. Never forget, though, that formlessness is a strategic pose. It gives you room to create tactical surprises. As your enemies struggle to guess your next move, they reveal their own strategy, putting them at a decided disadvantage. It keeps the initiative on your side, putting your enemies in the position of never acting, constantly reacting. It foils their spying and intelligence. Remember, formlessness is a tool. Never confuse it with a go-with-the-flow style or with a religious resignation to the twists of fortune. You use formlessness not because it creates inner harmony and peace, but because it will increase your power. Finally, learning to adapt to each new circumstance means seeing events through your own eyes, and often ignoring the advice that people constantly peddle your way. It means that ultimately you must throw out the laws that others preach, and the books they write to tell you what to do, and the sage advice of the elder. The laws that govern circumstances are abolished by new circumstances, Napoleon wrote, which means that it is up to you to gauge each new situation. Rely too much on other people's ideas, and you end up taking a form not of your own making. Too much respect for other people's wisdom will make you depreciate your own. Be brutal with the past, especially your own, and have no respect for the philosophies that are foisted on you from outside. Reversal. Using space to disperse and create an abstract pattern shouldn't mean forsaking the concentration of your power when it is valuable to you. Formlessness makes your enemies hunt all over for you, scattering their own forces, mental as well as physical. When you finally engage them, though, hit them with a powerful, concentrated blow. That is how Mao succeeded against the Nationalists. He broke their forces into small, isolated units, which he could then easily overwhelm with a strong attack. The law of concentration.